my sincerest hope is that intelligence continues to thrive in this part of the galaxy, and that whatever intelligence exists in the year 2500, that they will say, Brian Johnson lived in the early 21st century, and he was an extraordinary Homo sapien. That he was able to see the future with a clarity that few could see in his time. And while he was ridiculed and hated and ostracized from all of society, he demonstrated the tenaciousness to push forward on a future of intelligence that was more magnificent than that century could even begin to imagine. Hi, 25th century. My name is Brian Johnson. I lived in the early 21st century. I'm still around. I'm zero. I've changed quite a bit since then. Today, in 2024, I'm on Behind the Brand with Brian Elliott.
I love that so much. Brian, welcome. Thank you for having us to your secret lair, this undisclosed location somewhere in Southern California, we can say, hidden by high hedges and all the amenities. I usually ask my guests, how did you get this job?
I mean, it really started when I was 21 years old. I had this burning desire. I had just lived in Ecuador as a missionary for 2 years among extreme poverty. And it was the first time I had been shocked outside of the United States of our opulent life and in mud huts and dirt floors. And for some reason, the effect it had on me was I came back to the US and I just burned inside to want to improve the human race. I didn't know how. I wasn't sure what the path would be. I just felt like that's how I wanted to spend my life. And so I think what I'm doing now really has been the culmination of everything I've been doing for the past 25 years, trying to do something that makes a difference for the species.
I like it. Very concise. Thank you for the book, by the way. I'm intrigued. I mean, more than intrigued. I mean, it's kind of like an obsession for me too, this whole don't die philosophy, and I want to dig into that deep. Before we do, I want to kind of go back in the chronology a little bit, talk about young Brian. It's easy for me, you know, as another Brian, very relatable, and I think we have a lot more than just names in common. Mm-hmm. I want to go back in the chronology and talk about your upbringing, talk about your family as context to where you are now and sort of how you got there. I want to talk about that journey. So where did you grow up?
In a small town, 30,000 people, in southern Utah.
And what was that like? I mean, for people who have never lived in Utah before, it's quite a unique subculture, I would think.
It is. As a kid, I loved life. I rode my bike with my friends everywhere we went. We would ride each other's houses. We'd go home for lunch. We'd race every day to school, riding over flower patches, going through ditches. We played outside all the time. We built forts. We set traps. We just were always up to something. And I just remember my childhood as being phenomenal, endlessly fun.
It's suburbia there, right? I mean, it's like what I imagine Mayberry, you know, on TV, the Andy Griffith Show, you know, back in the day, like homemade apple pie on the windowsill, the whole nine yards.
Yeah.
Mom's making cookies.
Yes. It was just... fields and forests as far as the eye could see. We were right there at the Rocky Mountains, so 5,000 feet of mountain right above us. We were always hiking the mountains. And my parents split when I was 3, and my mother was a single mom and then got remarried when I was 8. We were poor. She made my clothing that I wore to school. In third grade, I knew my family was poor, and I knew my mom was struggling. And she would write me a check for $25 for lunch. And I felt bad that it was that expensive. So I made a deal with the lunch lady where I would clean the tables at lunch and then I would eat some leftover food and she wouldn't charge me. And so I wouldn't cash my mom's check. I just thought that my mom wouldn't notice. And she figured out, she found out that I was doing that. And she's like, you know, Brian, it's okay. Like you can have lunch at school. But yeah, I was aware that my family didn't have money and was trying to do what I could to help.
That's so fascinating. Even at that young age, you had that sort of self-awareness of what was happening around you. I mean, usually kids are so self-centered. They're so, you know, inter-focused that they don't know what's happening in the world around them, especially what's happening with their parents. Mm-hmm. You had siblings?
Yeah, there's five of us. I'm the third. I'm middle.
Okay, that's interesting. Is there any dynamic that stands out as being, I'm the oldest, if that matters to you at all.
I know you're kind.
Yeah. Yes. So did you feel like the typical middle child? Boys and girls, how is it split?
Yeah, boy, girl, boy, boy, boy.
Boy, girl, boy, boy, boy. Yeah. Okay, so yeah, I mean, you're the second oldest boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe living in your brother's shadow a little bit, or?
We were a tight-knit family, and we became each other's best friends.
Okay, that's awesome.
Yeah, and I think we had a great time together. We had a lot of family rituals, and my oldest brother, he set himself up as a general, as a king in the house. And he named me as his general to enforce his laws and execute in the family.
I like it.
Yeah, so.
Okay. I mean, pathologizing a little bit, that kind of makes sense to me right off the bat because, you know, maybe your dad's out of the picture, your mom's single mom raising you guys.
Yeah.
He had to step up into that kind of, you know, man of the house role. And then he starts, you know, enlisting all the other siblings.
Yeah.
You know, to sort of help run the show.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of psychological layers that we're all unfamiliar with. How we were dealing with the situation. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
what kind of rituals did you have? I'm curious about that.
My mom would take us on a date every Friday night,
individually.
So once a week individually, then the entire family on Friday night, and we typically
That's busy with five kids.
Yeah, yeah, she's a wonderful mother.
Yeah,
and
amazing.
She would have a budget. We'd have like a play budget of like $5 on the weekend. And so we could decide to go to Hardee's and get $1 hamburgers, each one of us, or we could spend $5 and go through the car wash.
And, you didn't like go to the creamery or anything?
No, it was too expensive.
Yeah.
And with our $5 budget. And so we would oftentimes choose the car wash because we just thought that was the most amazing experience ever to be swallowed up by bubbles. But you know, then we'd come home and we'd watch The Dukes of Hazzard that was on, I think, at 6 p.m. And yeah, we just had fun as a family. We had a little garden in the back. We grew corn and
tomatoes. Wait a minute. I'm surprised that your mom let you watch The Dukes of Hazzard. I mean, there's some shenanigans going on there. You had Daisy Dukes in her sort of inappropriate short shorts. I mean, immodest short shorts. You had the boys kind of, you know, getting into trouble.
Yeah, it's funny, we didn't really think about those kinds of things. Like, for example, one night we convinced my mom to take us out and go water ballooning. So we filled up a bunch of water balloons. Mm-hmm. We got in the van, we rolled down all the windows, and we drove around and threw water balloons at pedestrians, at cars. And my mother was right in there with us. And, you know, we tell that story today and she's like, oh, like, what was I thinking? Like, how did that pass my judgment as a good idea? But in the moment as a family, we were just like, that's going to be fun. Let's do that. And so many of our
memories. Look out.
You know, there would be like people sitting at the bus stop and we would just roll up and, you know, and soak them.
Yeah.
But I suppose it was just time and place and culture. And as a family, we did it. And it's like we did a lot of things. We look back now as highly questionable. In the moment, we just had so much fun doing them. So we've always been kind of like rascals. I mean, I guess I always have been.
Yeah, that's funny. There's probably someone, you know, thinking about their early childhood, thinking about those damn Johnson family came by and you know, pelted us with the balloons. Someone's holding a grudge.
But the thing is, the culture in our neighborhood, for example, is you could walk up and down the street and just walk into people's houses.
Yeah.
We were that familiar with each other and that comfortable. It was such a beautiful feeling to just know everybody and everyone's cool and contributing to the community.
Put a timestamp on that. Like what year are we talking about?
In the 80s.
Yeah. So Dukes of Hazzard, you know, Chips is on TV.
Yeah.
Dukes of Hazzard, Brady Bunch.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and now suspects. Like the sleep that the, you know, street I live on, I know a handful of my neighbors, but it's not like we walk up and down the street and go visit each other in a free fashion. So it's just, it's a different community structure. I really do. I enjoyed that. Yeah, pretty wholesome.
Yeah, and if you've been to Utah, I mean, there's just kids everywhere. It's an explosion of kids.
Yeah.
And like nowhere else in the world will you just see kids at play everywhere. You know, whether it's going out to eat or just, you know, there's just kids, an abundance of kids.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 10X kids.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's just the culture of families. It's a family-centered place. And yet there's also a very dark underbelly that a lot of people don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you get to the point where you did your mission. Did your brothers and sisters do missions too, or is it just the boys?
My sister and I did. So two of the five kids did.
Okay, interesting. And the others chose not to,
mm-hmm.
for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they had their reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So what compelled you to do it? In spite of some of the maybe others who went different directions.
Yeah.
Were you trying to be the good boy or the?
You know, it's really hard for me to try to speak rationally and coherently about why I did what I did. And I feel like even in this moment, if I were to reconstruct it, I would just be making something up. It's, I remember, for example, like in leaving the church, eventually, my rational mind would say, this doesn't make any sense. I don't actually think it's true. And then my emotional mind would be like, but what if, or like, what about?
Yeah. What is that? It's like, it's called Occam's razor, right? It's like, you know, even if it's not true, there's these possibilities. There's all these different philosophical ways to look at it. Yeah.
Yeah. And when you, it might be if someone's listening to this and they're having a hard time resonate with it, it's when you're raised in a culture that is so consuming, like it was the only reality that I understood existed for 19 years.
Yeah.
And so it's not like in that culture, you're presented with several ideas about reality and you're invited to truth seek. You're told that is the only true reality and every other reality is bad.
Yeah.
And they need to be corrected. And it's so, I mean, when you're in the womb, you're being taught this. And so trying to actually muster self-awareness to understand when you're in that environment, it's almost impossible.
I agree. It's impossible. You know, both of us have talked offline about growing up in a high demand religion.
Yeah.
We're talking about, you know, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, otherwise known as the Mormons.
Mm-hmm.
Very high demand religion, not the only high demand religion in the world. I mean, you know, you could argue that there's several others, but Mormonism is unique, especially in Utah. I grew up in Southern California. Mm. I have a different perspective. I don't really understand the subculture of Utah, although, you know, I try to, but having been brought up or having been raised there, I'm sure, you know, you have this unique perspective on it. But I agree. Like, let's talk about that. Let's talk about indoctrination and maybe as a bigger context of not just religion, but like even now what you're doing with your businesses, getting people to unlearn unhealthy habits, your whole philosophy about like, let's make now a little heaven on earth. Mm-hmm. Let's not wait until the eternities to start capturing our reward and celebrating life and, you know, being the best that we can be.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, looking back, the perspective I wish I would have had is to be helped in thinking about that in the past 200,000 years that Homo sapiens have been around, there have been thousands of civilizations. Egyptians, Greeks, Romans, Mesopotamians, you know, Persians, thousands. You have island communities. And every single one was slightly different in how they understood reality.
Right.
You know, whether they believed in a god or not, who those gods were, what those gods did, what their ethical and moral rules were, what they cared about, what the social dynamics were. Like you're born into one of these thousands of realities.
Right. And that is your reality. Yeah.
And it's an arbitrary construct.
Yeah. Just by nature of,
time and place.
Yeah. Who your parents are. Yeah.
So what I wish someone would have explained to me is, okay, you're born into this construct. There's been thousands and they arbitrarily form around these certain rule sets. None are universal truths. So you're really in this arbitrary set. None of it's true. There's not a single thing that's true about this reality. It's just the rules you're given. So if you can understand that as your starting point for understanding reality, then it frees you. Otherwise, you're enslaved by your reality. Like all you see is the omnipresent rules of your reality. And that's what I feel like my most significant accomplishment personally was, that realization. Because once you become free,
yes,
and unencumbered of your reality, for the very first time, you can begin to see clearly of not being trapped in what's superimposed upon you.
Yeah. I think that's so valuable. I liken it to coming out of a fog. For me, in my personal experience, it was like a spell was broken. Yeah. You know, you see that, remember that scene from Sleeping Beauty,
yeah,
you know, where the prince, you know, kisses her and suddenly she wakes up from, you know, whatever. It, to me, it was like that kind of experience. I had this moment where suddenly, mm-hmm, I was on one side of the wall, not thinking critically,
yeah,
just, you know, eating the dog food, as they say, you know, regurgitating the indoctrination.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, and like a snap of a finger, somehow I had permission to think critically. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wait a second, that can't be. And then, you know, it starts to sort of unravel the whole sweater,
yeah,
relatively quickly.
That's right.
And I think the same thing can be applied, that same sort of critical thinking can be applied to lifestyle too.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Brian, what's the hardest part about being you right now?
Nothing. I am the most free and the most joyful and the most stable I have been in my entire life. I wouldn't change my position for anything.
That's saying a lot. but there's got to be, you've got to have challenges. You're still human. I mean, contrary to what the internet thinks, that you're some sort of vampire or a reptilian or a visitor from another planet.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I went to this dinner with some friends a couple of weeks ago, and the friend who organized it framed the conversation of each person, express a problem, and then we as a group will help you out. Mm-hmm. And I should probably say there was this funny moment where this woman was explaining her relationship dissatisfaction.
Okay.
And about, you know, the challenges she was having.
Yeah.
And, you know, without missing a beat, everybody on the table started offering relationship advice.
Okay.
And so I said, can I just pause for a second? I said, who here at this table is currently in a successful relationship? And no one raised their hand.
Okay.
I said, so can we reflect that it's possible that no one here at this table is qualified to offer advice?
Yeah.
So, and then that was a funny moment of like, you know, because most of the time our social interactions are meant for cohesion. They're not meant for truth seeking, right? And this is kind of a situation where like just self-check on awareness. But when it got to me, I was the second to the last person. And I said, okay, everyone, I basically don't have any problems. Tell me what my problem should be. And then the table went nuts. Like they were so adamant at telling me what my problem should be, what I should be concerned about, how my comments revealed that I have some psychological issue. And like, it was...
What were some of the highlights? Like, of course, this is the peanut gallery talking. So it's like, we take it with a grain of salt, right?
Well, it's just, I mean, the adamancy in which they wanted me to have burning problems. And I mean, yes, I've got problems. I have hundreds of problems in life, but none of them are to a point where I'm bothered by them. It's fine. In the context of existence, of like, we're on this rock in space in this galaxy. Honestly, I'm great. Like, I'm just so happy to be alive.
Yeah.
And like, it, but that was such an unacceptable answer. And I just had to laugh because, you know, like, but then people were like diagnosing me with like a psychiatric condition. And right. So it was funny and fun. But
like, you're in denial or things like that.
Yeah. And like, I, yeah.
Okay, so let me push back on that a little bit, which is to say, I mean, you've been at this sort of new regime for what, about 3 years, right? On this new health kick, let's call it.
Yeah.
This new fad. No, kidding. So how long did it take you to get to that mindset? Because I think, you know, we're talking about philosophical things like the way we see the world, mm-hmm. you know, our place in the world. And what you're talking about is perspective. I mean, we get to choose the way we see ourselves, the way we see the world. And it may not even be real, but it's like whatever we choose then becomes reality.
Yeah.
So you're now telling me I don't have any problems, especially compared to, you know, everything else in the world. It's like, I got it pretty good. But like, how long did it take you to get there? Mm.
Yeah, my entire life.
Yeah. So that's a thing.
It is. This is, I would love to spend all of my time speaking with people, people aged between 12 and 19, mm-hmm. right? In the stage of life where they are trying to understand reality and they're in a vicious environment where kids are very mean.
Oh yeah.
Well, humans are mean, but like, you know, kids are especially mean.
Yeah.
And like their brains are not fully formed. And and their hormones are going crazy. It's just a really tough environment. I would love to be able to spend all of my time with them mm-hmm. and to try to give them perspective on a few ways to understand reality that could be incredibly useful. I got trapped in a lot of things that were very harmful. I mean, like, for example, even being trapped in a belief system is a torture, you know, because you're told exactly what existence is. You're told what rules you have to play by in order to achieve the outcome. It creates all kinds of negative feelings of shame and guilt and suppression, and it's really terrorizing.
Yeah.
And, you know, to free people up and say, actually, reality is not like that.
Right.
That is not really what's happening right now.
Right. And it's all under the guise of, this is a very good religion, they tell you, like, this is a great way to grow up. And it's insidious, I think.
Yeah. Well, even, I mean, religion, yes, but also, like, for example, someone growing up now that, you know, okay, so here are the things that, you know, you should be eating junk food. You should be staying up late. You should be on your phone all the time. You should not be taking care of your health. Life, the future is awful. We don't want to get jobs. We feel like we're everything's terrible. I mean, like, even in any situation, this is what I'm saying. It's not just religion. It's thousands of civilizations that have sprung up into existence that create realities. Mm-hmm. None are inherently true. None, not a single one. And so in any given moment, the only task I see for myself is to try to muster the greatest sobriety possible, the absolute most crisp perspective of reality, to not get distracted by a mirage, but like, who can generate the most penetrating insight about existence? And that's my constant search. And that's what I'd like to help others is, like, that's your quest. Don't be owned by what people tell you reality is. It's all false constructs.
Yeah. And that includes probably looking for blind spots all the time.
Yes.
What are some of your blind spots?
Yeah, the most useful thing, so depression taught me a lesson I am forever grateful for, which is I am not my mind.
Right.
And I don't trust my mind. So when a thought lands into my mind, that's not me. That is not representative of me. It's not what I care about. It's just what has landed in my mind. And so I now have so when my mind was saying, hey, you are depressed, life is worthless, life is meaning, like, you shouldn't continue to exist. You should probably commit suicide because that's the best way out. There's no reason to exist. Then I can say to my mind, thank you. Yeah. Yep. Appreciate your perspectives. Yeah. Also, you know,
shut up, please.
Yeah. Also, yeah. I'm, yeah. And, you know, I now basically in every given moment, like the reason I pause so much is in any given moment, confronted with any question, I know the first three or four thoughts that drop into my mind are going to be wrong.
Mm.
Majorly wrong or slightly wrong, but they're going to be wrong. And I have to basically just figure out how to be less wrong in every given moment. But the first thought that comes to mind is typically you want to repeat what everyone else has said, because that is safe and that's what you are familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go one level deeper and say, maybe not, you have to parse it out in some way. Like, is this a science question? Is this a culture question? Is this a, you know, an investigation question? But it's really learning how to dance through your mind actively trying to sabotage you into believing incorrect things and it passing your filters so you don't realize it just happened. And then you end up with a false belief because you haven't caught it.
Yeah. And if I'm looking at you online, sort of you're very, you're out there on Twitter, for example, or you're, mm-hmm. you know, you're having these sort of looks like Twitter battles. How have you become so resilient? I mean, has it taken you time to become so thick skinned? Or I mean, because there's a whole like wave of, let me ask you this. What have you been surprised about?
Yeah.
Because to me, you're only advocating for good. It's like, hey, everyone, let's be healthy. Let's, you know, get better sleep. Let's eat better. Let's think more about, you know, the health of our organs. Let me help pave the way. I'll literally be the human guinea pig for you. Go through all this testing, spend all this money on your behalf. And then I'm going to open the kimono and show you, what I've learned. And yet you get all this hate or pushback or, so what's been the most surprising? Let's start there. That surprises me that's the reaction.
Yeah.
Does it surprise you?
The potentially obvious answer here is that people aren't talking about me. They're talking about themselves.
Right. Okay.
So it's a self-reflection exercise that's just directed my way. And then the second thing is, how much authority do I grant other humans? You know, if someone says something, how much do I care?
Right.
And it's basically zero.
Right. It's this idea like, listen, if I've done anything to offend you, call me and let's work it out. But like, if you don't have my phone number and we don't know each other, then it doesn't matter to me, right? Like we're not even close, so who cares?
Yeah, maybe I'm saying something maybe a bit more extreme. I'm basically saying, if you look throughout the history of the human race, like how respectable are our opinions over time? How much do we get right and how much do we get wrong? And how much do we trust emotional reaction? I'm saying I give zero credence. I just don't care.
Yeah.
I don't care. And I don't care what my mind says. I don't care what other people say. In any given moment, the 25th century is going to view us as cavemen.
Right. I've heard you talk about that.
If I'm hanging out with Homo erectus and Homo erectus, the tribe, is dunking on Homo erectus, what's my advice to Homo erectus? Is it like, you should feel shame and guilt because you've brought the tribe's collective ire on you. But this is the thing is, this is what I'm talking about where I feel joyful. I feel absolutely unencumbered by reality. And that includes all humans. It's not a force I care about. I have to play by the rules of gravity.
Yeah.
I've got to play by the rules of physics and of biology. But the rules of humans, not a game I care to play.
What fascinates me though is what was the tipping point? Like when did you figure that out? Because that mindset, I mean, you look so stoic when you talk about it. You seem so focused. Like, you know, they talk about left brain, right brain people. Like, were you born that way? Were you just hardwired that way? or like you got back from Ecuador? When did that transformation happen? Because it seems like it's a transformation.
Yeah, it's like
stepped through a portal or something.
Yeah, so I went through a few gates. So like the first one was in my early 20s, I discovered behavioral psychology. And I learned of the 188 biases that we humans have.
Yeah.
Now, up until that point, I confidently believed that I was logical and rational and consistent. And then I discovered how flawed my brain was. Like, I am majorly flawed, like all humans.
Yeah, we have confirmation bias. We have all the...
Exactly. Our minds absolutely distort reality.
Yeah.
And when I discovered that, it was such a shocking moment because I thought, wait a second, I was so confident that I understood reality.
I see.
And now I can become self-reflective and I can see myself in action distorting reality. And mm-hmm. it's like, what?
Yeah.
Like I'm a disaster of cognition. And then I went through depression and my mind's, you know, dunking on me all the time. And it's like, okay, actually, my mind is not correct.
Right. You know, it's self-sabotage.
Yep. So like now I've got two examples. And then I depart the church. And so I had trusted the church authorities. I mean, good people, well-intentioned, really taking care of my best interest. And then I realized, that they whitewashed the entire history of the religion that they were telling me about. Mm-hmm. An absolute dishonest act where I had not received correct information my entire life.
Right.
At that point, I can't trust those who had put my absolute trust in. So now I've got three successive situations where I say the authority that I thought that I trusted, myself, my mind, religion, authorities my entire life who had ruled my reality. And then it just started to cascade from there. And I realized who in existence can I actually trust? And it was kind of like almost no one.
Yeah.
And that's why when the ire comes my way, I don't care. Like, I don't trust them. Yeah. I don't trust their perspectives. I don't trust their thoughts. I don't trust their emotions. I don't trust anyone. None of us should.
Yeah.
And this is why I really feel absolutely nothing. I just feel joy when haters come my way and they come with their stinging comments. It just brings me joy. It's like this emergent human consciousness trying to make sense of reality and through all these wild emotions. It's, to me, it's just frolic and play.
I mean, that's amazing. I hope to get even close to that point at some point. I mean, when you're describing, your alternate realities breaking, I mean, it reminds me of the Truman movie, the Jim Carrey movie and everything he believed was a complete sham. It was a show, actually,
Yeah, that's right.
And that's how it kind of felt for me when I was deconstructing.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like I felt duped and I felt that I'd been living this lie and, everything just unraveled from there. But so it's very relatable what you're talking about.
Yeah. This is like when I raise my children, I don't go to them with answers. I go to them and help them ask questions. And I try to help them deconstruct their realities. Mm-hmm. And I tell them, I am not a source of truth for you. I'm going to be a sounding board for you as you navigate reality, because how you journey is going to be different than I have. But what I want us to have in common is we both are open-minded that everything we basically understand is some construct, it's some illusion.
Right.
And we're just continually peeling back the layers. Even now, everything I understand in reality is probably going to be peeled away and I'll be onto the next version. So it's step by step trying to deconstruct reality with the most sober sense possible.
So speaking of, you've got three children. And Talmadge is your oldest. I mean, he's been, in some of your videos and he makes appearances on Instagram and things. And you guys seem like best friends actually at this point. Mm-hmm. How are the other two doing? Are they, they're younger, I would expect.
Yeah, there's actually Talmadge is number two. I have a 20-year-old, 18, and then my daughter's 14.
Okay.
Yeah, so their mother and I got divorced when the oldest was 10. And, being a good father was extremely important to me. And so I worked really, really hard to be a good dad. I mean, in every way. I coached all their teams. I would take each on a date, you know,
like your mom did.
I went all in on being a dad. And so the divorce was pretty challenging because it ruptured my reality of having to now be a divorced dad. And then the kids were kind of in a tough spot because they had to decide between dad who had left the religion and mom who had stayed in. And when you're 10, 8, and 4, you can't make those kinds of decisions.
No, I mean, your whole world is wrapped around that culture anyway.
Exactly. And so I sat them down. I basically, one afternoon, I said, I would like to share with you why I made the decision the decisions I did, and I could tell they were uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because the church teaches you to, like, anyone who challenges our beliefs is the devil and you should cast them out.
Yeah.
And so
shun the non-believer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I said, look, we're going to call a truce. I'm not coming back. So, like, you know, you do you, I will do me. We will be a family and I'm going to be the best father I can to you, but I'm not going to try to get you to change your religious beliefs because that's going to create a fracture and I don't want that. I really want to be your father. And so, but over the years, I mean, I remember this, like my father had left the church and the church taught me that he was a bad guy, that he was other. And the only objective I had with his was to bring him back into the church.
Right.
Like, that's it.
Playing the long game.
That's it.
Yeah.
And, but I couldn't actually appreciate my father in any other dimension other than seeing it through the lens of him being part of this religious organization. And it really limited my ability to develop a relationship.
Yeah.
And so they were in a similar situation where I was painted as the bad guy. And they should be wary of me. And so, we've always got along very well. We've never fought. We have split custody, and I spent a lot of time doing things with them, but I was never able to cross into their world as a figure of authority.
Yeah, you lose all credibility the second you step outside.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're an outsider.
Exactly. And so that organization is more powerful than you. As a father, you're stripped of all your power.
Right.
You cannot say anything that is authoritative.
Yeah.
You're absolutely worthless to them.
Yeah.
And not even worthless. Like, you're a danger to them. Whereas, so Talmadge, he started to be opening up to me at the age 15 and then more and more. And then when he turned 17, he decided to come live with me.
Okay.
And so, and we have become best friends. So one of my three children, has been open-minded, and this is not a critique of the other two. You know, they're doing their thing. I understand it. I've been that. So, like, cool. But yeah, it's definitely a surprise outcome that I didn't anticipate, you know, in the beginning.
Yeah, that's so hard. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
It's so hard. It's the worst, actually. It's the absolute worst.
Yep. That is well said. It's, words can't quite capture how awful it is.
Yeah. I understand perfectly. So where's your belief system now? Like, you know, where did we come from? Why are we here?
Yeah.
Where are we going?
Yeah.
How has that changed? What's your perspective on life? I mean, you're trying your best not to die. I get it. I love it. I'm all in. I don't want to die either. But like, what's your perspective on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, you know, an educated person could say, well, you know, the galaxy is roughly, you know, 13.8 billion years old. The universe is 13.8 billion years, and the Earth is 4.48, or whatever the numbers are. You know, the numbers are always changing. But like, a person could rattle off an early 21st century understanding of physics.
Neil deGrasse Tyson did that to me. Took me to school on physics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a homo sapien in this age could say that. Now, another way of doing that would be to say, okay, so these are the perspectives of early 21st century Homo sapiens. If history continues to be like it has been, our understanding of reality is going to change constantly.
Yeah.
So this is like our current best version. There's like, we came into existence somehow. This is our best guess. But I guess I really like to lean into not knowing. Because like, okay, so sure, like maybe that's true, maybe it's not. But the opportunity is not in repeating what society thinks it knows. It's in exploring what we don't know.
Yes, yes. That's been my experience too. It's like, it used to matter. It used to be everything.
Yeah.
You'd live for the future.
Yeah.
And now you live for the present.
Yeah.
But also not knowing is just fine.
Yeah.
And it's somewhat actually more of a relief not to have it all figured out.
Yeah. I even say in addition to that, that up until this point, intelligence in society has been one's knowledge. And so you basically learn a given thing, you can regurgitate that on tests and get good grades, but it's been in your knowledge. And that's what drives a lot of what a person, how a person is valued in society, the kind of work they can do, the jobs they can have, a person's status in society has largely been their mastery of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that we are now in an era with artificial intelligence where not knowing is actually the intelligence that is most valued, because artificial intelligence is mastering all the things we do know and has a better grasp at it than we do, and will improve much faster than we will. And so it no longer makes sense to allocate our scarce metabolic activity to the acquisition of knowledge and mastery of it. It makes much more sense to use our scarce metabolic activity into searching for brand new primitives, brand new ideas, and being on the frontier of exploration. And so I'd say that's the shift. And that's where I talked to Talmadge, where Talmadge is going to a school, University of Chicago, where he is in an old system of intelligence, where they're mastering certain things. Now, it's not entirely useful. Like, he's useless. He's learning physics and he's learning computer science. And so he's learning practical things that will be helpful. Also, as a society, I don't think we've fully grokked the situation that we're no longer knowledge masters. We are a different form of intelligence, and it's going to be a shift that basically plays to our worst fears of not knowing. That's typically where we do not like hanging out, in the area of not knowing. It makes us feel very uneasy. We like knowing. We like being able to predict and model things out. And when we don't know, we feel unmoored.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people can argue philosophically that that's where religion was born, in this, man's search for whatever, the pursuit of where do we come from, like where are we headed, and that fear of the unknown is, at the heart of everything that we do.
Yeah.
And that makes sense. We used to, back in the day, rely on encyclopedias. We don't need that anymore. We have the internet. And then fast forward to this next phase, which is already here. The future is now with AI, and things are happening quickly. Can we go back to your early business days and talk a little bit about money for a second? Mm-hmm. So I've interviewed over 500 very successful people, probably the most successful or the smartest, you could argue, on the planet. And the net of most of these conversations is that money reveals your true character. Mm. It doesn't change you. It just reveals who you actually are underneath. Has that been your experience? Mm. You came into a lot of wealth. For those who don't know the context, I talk about, you had a windfall. You had a good idea.
Yeah.
It worked out for you.
Yeah.
I will also say, I think the lack of money reveals your true character. Mm. So I think it works both ways.
So I'm not sure if I have anything insightful to say about this question. I'll try. Last night, I went through a document that someone had put together for me. Once I sold Braintree Venmo, I made a few hundred million dollars, and I was trying to map my next stage of life. and I was trying to improve my self-awareness.
How old were you at the time this happened?
34.
Okay. So kind of right in the prime gear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was doing a lot of self-introspection. That was the same time I had gotten a divorce. I was rebuilding my models of reality. I was now a divorced father. And this person conducted interviews with like 10 or 15 people who were close to me in my personal and professional life. And she put together this 30-page document with all of these observations, answering questions about their views of me. And I read through it last night because my son and I were talking about something related to his aspirations in life. And I was making fun of myself. And I was like, you know, here's some things people said about me, kind of like dunking on me, which is great. And the thing that he pointed out, he said, "Dad, you're identical now to what you were then. Like, I would make the same observations about you." And so I would just say that, yeah, having gone from being poor my entire life to having a lot of money doesn't seem to have changed me much. It changes the games I play and how I solve problems and how I think about life. But the fundamentals, they, based upon this document of a snapshot in time, my personal experience, it seems like I've been basically the same human. But I do know, like, for example, I mean, there are things actually, okay, so like over the past, I've had money for 12 years, and of many people who have been the closest to me, almost half those who have worked close to me ended up stealing from me or basically doing something like they shouldn't have done.
Betrayal.
Yeah. And, you know, this is not to say they're bad and I'm good. It's just to say that being around money is complicated. Having money is complicated. It's definitely changed my relationship with everybody. And if, I think the common theme you would hear is if you talk to people who do have resources, is after having them for a certain duration of time, you do become wise in knowing that when you get approached by someone, usually it's because they want something. And their motives are typically hidden. You know, not everyone. Sometimes people genuinely show up to have a robust relationship personally or professionally. But money is definitely extremely complicated for everyone. So again, this is not like people with money are good and people without money are bad. This is like when you pair people with different levels of resources, that relationship is very complicated.
More money, more problems. I mean, this is tales all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. And the people I've spoken to, what I've experienced, they've said is very typical. You know, like they almost have gone through the exact same thing where 30 to 50% of those closest to them end up doing something that they shouldn't have done. Mm-hmm. And it's not like an arguable thing. It's like clearly everyone knows, like, yeah, that's not a thing that would be good. So, but yeah, you know, it's fine. It's just of the complexities of life. That's just one that is worthy to be mindful.
So what filters do you have in place or what systems do you have in place to, I mean, are you thinking about, you know, how to weed people out or how to filter people out? How are you auditing?
It's the cost of being human. Okay. Yeah. I mean, like I'm a trusting person.
Yeah.
And I really prefer that way of being. I don't want to micromanage. I don't want people to feel like I distrust them.
Yeah.
And so I guess I prefer that kind of culture and that kind of relationship. And then, you know, if it goes badly, then fine, we'll just clean it up afterwards. But yeah, I guess the quality of life and the quality of my relationships is really important. But I mean, like on the other side, like, okay, in certain relationships, I've become much more robust in terms of setting expectations in a very clear fashion. So everyone knows very, very clearly what is being expected of the party and what's being agreed upon. So there's no after the fact retelling mm-hmm. circumstances.
And what does that look like? Are we talking about like, hey, I go to sleep at 8:30 p.m., FYI, and I'm not budging on that, or I don't eat donuts anymore?
Yeah, I mean, like in, I'm working, I just completed a pair of documents with an attorney for people who are getting into a relationship. And so this document basically says, I'm encouraging it like on the second date.
Okay.
You know, like first date, introduce the idea, second date, sign this thing.
Like a pre
note. Exactly. It's like from the very beginning, and it is, the level of detail is surprising. And so it covers all expectations, you know, from confidentiality to assets to breakup to like you name everything. Yeah. And then also a detailed form of sexual consent.
So this would be good for someone like Drake too. I mean, like this could be a marketable tool.
Everybody.
Yeah.
And the sexual consent, it's so explicit, you know, it's foreplay. And it's like, we're going to do this, but not that. Mm. We're going to do this way, but not that way. It's got a ratchet clause where it says like, if we're in the heat of the moment and we both want to do a given thing, are we going to say, no, we're not going to do it? Or are we going to say, yes, we're willing to do this thing. And we can't have a written agreement in that moment. That's going to kill the mood. So we are agreeing that we do this. And so, but it's like, it's become so problematic over the years of the threat of lawsuit and the hassle of lawsuit forces the payment in this extortion world.
Yeah. I mean, you've been very forthcoming. I mean, forthcoming is not even the right word. You've been explicit about the hell you've been through the last couple of years. And it's, I mean, unfortunate doesn't even begin to describe it. It's like, you know, what looks like a living hell.
Yeah.
And so this is a byproduct of that experience.
It is. Absolutely.
And well, that makes sense. I mean, justifiable.
Yeah. Like, so in the stuff I've been through recently, I mean, when I started dating this person, I was just finishing up my divorce. And I had been we had gotten married and we were poor, right? And then we'd made $200 million while married.
Yeah.
And so when you put that kind of pile of money in a divorce, like, you know, it's just going to go to hell. Like lawyers are going to like just make everything like, it's just you
blood in the water. Yeah. Sharks coming. Yeah.
Everything goes to hell.
Yeah.
And so I just finished up with this brutal divorce and I said, I'm never, ever doing that again. Like that was just the worst.
Yeah.
And so when I started dating this woman, I said, we are going to write down everything. Mm-hmm. Everything's going to be in writing. Is going to be abundantly clear across the board. And so over that relationship, you know, we signed something like 7 agreements, mm-hmm. putting things in writing. Mm-hmm. And even with that, it still ended in a nightmare for me.
Yeah.
And so these documents are basically trying to improve the next iteration where it's honestly, it's a really big societal problem. Because when I talk to people, the number of people who have had this similar experience is so much larger than anyone realizes it. And it plagues society because we no longer know in society who we can trust and who we can't trust. And there's no guardrails on the systems that help us ensure that trust.
Yeah. Yeah. And it goes both ways, right? It's not like, I mean, both genders have major issues.
Yeah.
You know, women don't feel safe anywhere. They always, you know, are looking over the shoulder to be attacked or killed. You know, men seem to, you know, be susceptible to accusations that aren't true. I mean, it's just, it's rampant.
Yeah, it's definitely a, going back to like, what is the sober assessment here? As a species, we have a problem of truth telling and we have a problem with memory and we have a problem with memory and truth telling when we want things and we have a problem with those things when we want vengeance and it creates a whole bunch of societal damage where it really is harmful for all of us. And so again, if you're playing this game where death is inevitable, whatever, like do your thing. But if you're really trying to play the biggest of all games and don't die, then it really causes reflection on how do you build civilization trust? Mm-hmm. What are the rules? And right now, we're not playing to the level of a civilization goal. We're playing to a level of we're all going to die inevitably, so we might as well just each get our own in the most violent way possible.
Yeah, it's crabs in a bucket, like they say.
It is.
I'm trying to grab. Can I go back to intentions for a second? So do you consider yourself and your mission here, what you're doing, like as an altruistic mission? Because, I mean, it's there's an opportunity to make money, mm-hmm. But you're also making it free and available to the general public. It's not like you need to have money and resources to be able to learn how you're doing it. I mean, your skin looks fantastic, by the way.
Thanks.
And so, like, would you consider yourself altruistic? Like, what's the intention? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess I think about history. I think about people, historical figures, more than I think about any other model. And so, you know, were the founding fathers, were they altruistic? Or were they really trying to do status signaling in their position of power of government and being like, I just don't know if there's any such thing as like, you know, is any human really good or not? We all have such mixed motivations and we're also complicated and we want to tell pretty stories about ourselves and we want ourselves to have a clean narrative and we want to be viewed positively by people, but we're all secretly motivated by these different things. So like, yeah. I don't know, I kind of, this goes back to maybe our shared upbringing where I was taught as a kid, my entire actually first 19 years of life to only look at the positive side, only say positive things, only think positive things. And the dark side was to be avoided at all costs. That meant any, you know, like dark side, I mean like the inverse of any thought, the, yeah.
If at first you see a frown,
smile. You nailed it. Right. But like anything. So like,
No, I get it.
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to imagine like what viewers think. Like dark is not negative. Like dark means it's like half of reality is light, half of reality is dark. And you basically can't see half of reality.
Yeah, and also, you know, we're mammals. It's like, you know, we're still animals.
Yeah.
Even though we're Homo sapiens, like we're still animals. Each of us has the ability to do terrible things.
Yeah.
If we lose control or, you know, whatever the, like, you know, push to a certain point, it's in us.
Yeah, exactly. So like, yeah. This is the question, like, am I altruistic? Like, I think what I want to say is I'm 50% light and 50% dark.
Yeah. So like, you're a little truistic, not altruistic, a little truistic.
Like, I mean, like, I'd rather like, can we just be honest about ourselves and for a moment not try to create pretty stories. Like, is the human race the best thing that ever graced this earth? We're 50% light and we're 50% dark. Like, yeah. Not clear we're a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, like, so it's just the reality, but we, this creates these skewed perceptions of ourselves, of each other, of society. And I would much rather try the sobriety effort than I would the pretty story, which covers things up.
Okay. So as we wrap things up, this series is called Behind the Brand. We talk about the brand. I know that you're a human on your way to becoming maybe superhuman, maybe me too, in the age of AI, who knows. But how would you define the Brian Johnson brand? Mm. And then how does that, you know, translate over to Blueprint and Kernel, some of the things that you're doing?
Yeah. My sincerest hope is that intelligence continues to thrive in this part of the galaxy, and that whatever intelligence exists in the year 2500, that they will say, Brian Johnson lived in the early 21st century, and he was an extraordinary Homo sapien, that he was able to see the future with a clarity that few could see in his time. And while he was ridiculed and hated and ostracized from all of society, he demonstrated the tenaciousness to push forward on a future of intelligence that was more magnificent than that century could even begin to imagine. And we appreciate his efforts because we benefit from them today. Now, this is the same thing I would say about hundreds of people in the previous centuries. I would use those same words.
Nikola Tesla, Thomas Edison, Mahatma Gandhi. I mean, a lot of these, what's the phrase? You know, like, first they hate you, you know, and then ultimately they want to be like you. I mean, that's the arc.
And there's a...
of most of these outliers.
There's right? There's a very, very small number of people in society who move the species forward in a meaningful way.
And it's the same arc.
Same arc.
Right? It's all the pushback, all the hatred, the exactly. vitriol. Yeah. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, maybe...
Exactly.
Maybe that peaceful protest idea is kind of a good idea, or...
This goes back to your question of like, what do I think about the hate that comes my way? This is why I honestly could care less.
Do you study history? Are you pretty avid history?
That's how I've learned. That's my reality.
Yeah.
But like, if you look throughout history, it is algorithmic. It's so predictable.
Yeah.
That it's meaningless.
Economies, you know, wars. Just the way people operate.
Exactly. Humans. So when you put that in perspective,
yeah.
and then when humans start lobbing hatred and insult your way, all you can do is laugh because they're oblivious to their time and place, and they're doing their best to in their circumstances, but they're oblivious to the larger contextual element of us existing in this part of the galaxy.
Yeah.
And that's where I've gained freedom, is I have this relationship with the centuries before me, and I have this relationship with the centuries ahead of me.
Yeah.
And I'm genuinely trying to be useful in the 21st century to genuinely move the human race forward. And this is, we have never been, after 4.5 billion years on this earth, we have never been in a more consequential moment than right now. Like, literally within like these years will make or break this species. And I mean, it is full on. And so we're all stuck with the drama of day-to-day, you know, interactions with relationships and work and politics. And like, we're consumed by this, you know, but...
distractions, really. Where are we in the life cycle? It feels like we're in the torches and pitchfork phase. Mm. How soon till you're out of that and like into the next productive phase?
I mean, I think initially almost everyone misunderstood me. And then there's been a phase recently where a lot of people have come around and said, actually, right, like there's more to the story here. There's something else to be understood. Yeah. And I've gotten a lot of people who are joining.
I love this running group that you've got going.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost like, I remember that movie Forrest Gump, where Forrest starts, he's the solo runner doing his own thing. And all of a sudden people see what he's doing. And then like, there's this huge movement that's happening.
Yep.
I feel like it's kind of things happening.
Last week we had Don't Die meetups in 58 countries, over 3,000 people gathered.
Yeah.
And this is in like just putting out a few messages on social media, but like in the past couple of weeks, several major groups have tried to do takedowns on me. So we're in the phase where powerful interests are trying to do takedowns on me to discredit me. Mm. And so it's great. Again, like absolutely algorithmic. Yeah. I know it's coming.
Well, it's a sign that you're on the right track.
Yeah, too, right? So it's great. And so I'm going to make it through this. And this is like what I've learned in reading history. This is the algorithm. Mm-hmm. And so when you have that perspective, you know, these things just come and go.
What size of company's Blueprint right now? Like, what's your revenue look like?
We're teeny.
Yeah.
Yeah, we just started.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you've got your first... is it just one or two? You have the olive oil.
Yeah.
I'm a huge olive oil fan. I'm just learning about it, but like,
yeah,
I'm doing I have like a little shot glass. I fill it half full of olive oil, virgin olive oil. I'm sure it's trash oil. I'd love to buy yours. Then I put a little cayenne pepper and a little lemon. I do that lemon shot.
That's fun.
And it feels like it gets my circulation going. It feels like it's good for digestion.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's promising. I think we're going to have a pretty good year. I mean, we We started selling olive oil 2 months ago.
Where are you getting it? Is it like from Sicily? Like where are you getting
all over the world. Yeah. Both hemispheres.
Can you get quality then?
I mean, yeah. I think we will become, I think in the next few months, the largest supplier of extra virgin olive oil in the world from a standstill. And yeah.
You and organized crime. I mean, did you have to run into any of that? That's so cool.
Yeah. I think
like Northern Italy controls like them.
Yeah.
I don't want to say, you know, the M word, but it's like, let's say organized crime has a lot to do with the olive oil.
They're doing a good job on their olives.
Yeah.
But like I've priced the olive oil. So we're basically not making any money.
Okay.
And
right now.
Yeah. But also, I'm genuinely trying to move the needle. This is not a money grab.
Yeah.
And extra virgin olive oil is one of the very best things that somebody can do for their health and wellness.
Yeah. This is heart health?
Whole body health. Yeah. It's phenomenal. If you look at the evidence, it's a superfood. And people don't know how to determine what is quality olive oil. No one publishes their data. So it's impossible. It's a superfood, but yet everyone's duping everyone. And so we basically provide third party lab testing evidence of the high quality nature of our oil and basically selling it at cost to try to get people, get everyone access to this high quality food at the lowest possible price.
Mm-hmm. And where does it compare price wise to others? Like, do you price it out by ounce, by liter, how's it priced out?
It's currently priced at $20 per bottle.
Okay. And how many ounces per bottle?
750 ml. So what is that? 26 ounces.
Okay. And how does that compare to like something I would buy at Whole Foods or something?
Yeah. Costco would probably sell, I don't know what the comparable is, but, I think Costco sells maybe some comparable volume for maybe $10, $15. I don't know.
Half the cost.
Yeah. I don't know what the per ounce comparison is.
Yeah.
But you know, like if you're looking for the health benefits, you know, it's like basically worthless.
Yeah. Or damaging.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the way I've understood omega-3 fish oils, like some of it gotten from different Chinese factories that are not reliable or they get it from oceans that are filled with mercury.
Yeah.
You might as well not take it instead of taking it. You know, it's better to take high grade omega-3, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, I think people are basically like, I'm going through this stage of credibility where people are wondering like, is this going to be like an Elizabeth Holmes situation where we find out he's faked all his data, you know, like, or is this going to be the situation of like SBF where like we figure out there's been some accounting fraud or whatever.
Right.
And so I'm just going through these basic milestones where people are like, is he trustworthy? Like, is this legit or is this all going to fall apart? So I'm chalking up day by day, more and more evidence to say, this is legit. I am what you think I am. I am what I say I am. And you know, it'll just take me some time to earn a place in people's lives where they say, yes, like there's a long enough track record here. We trust him. And so that's what I'm trying to earn.
You think that's what it takes to build a credible brand? I mean, you know, brand is not just what you say it is. It's like what other people think of you, right?
Yeah.
It's not your logo. It's not, it's about experiences. But are you doing anything deliberate to build, like say Blueprint, for example, like, aside from a blue bottle, what are some of these brand building things that you're doing?
It's like it's everything you and I do in life when we try to figure out if we can trust somebody. You know, when the person makes a mistake, do they confess or do they lie? You know, if the person takes one more golf swing to get the ball in the hole, do they cheat on their card? Or do they tell the truth?
Right.
You know, like if you get a bad result, do you publish it? You know, so all these small things that we do to say, is this person trustworthy or do they lie? And so every single day is another experience someone has with me where they say, can I trust this guy, Brian Johnson? And, you know, I'm doing something new and it's unfamiliar. And so people are trying to create models of like what's really happening here. And so this is a large part what this 5,000 person study is. Like, you know, I've been doing this in myself, but everyone's like, well, it's just you, but no one else. And I was like, wow, actually, let's try it on 5,000 people. Let's see. And so we're putting it through the rigor of scientific measurement. Mm-hmm. we'll get outcomes. Like whether it will all be positive, we'll see. Like, but it'll be a process where we collectively evaluate it.
And what will be required of these 5,000? And you know, are they? Is it a cross section of just the United States, North America, or is it international?
Yeah, it's five countries: U.S., Canada, U.K., Canada. Oh, wait, U.S., Canada, U.K., Germany, Australia.
Okay. And do they have to live the Brian Johnson routine regimen?
No.
Okay. So
no,
what's required?
It's just consuming one drink in the morning, eight pills, 1 mL nutty pudding, and extra virgin olive oil.
How did you decide on those eight pills out of the like 120 that you take every day or something?
Yeah.
How many are you taking now?
Daily I take, well, I'm on Blueprint now, so it's less, but before I was doing, over 100.
Yeah.
We basically consolidated into these pills.
Yeah.
But what we did is the thing we did that was unique in the world is we combed through all the scientific evidence on health span and lifespan. We ranked the highest value therapies. We then assessed according to the believability of the evidence. Mm-hmm. And then we implemented every single thing we could in me according to power laws.
Right.
And no one in history had done that before in a systematic way, all evidence into one human. And then we did the same process to say, now, can we do that and put it into a product for the population, every gender, every age? Mm-hmm. And that's what we did. And so that's what we're testing now. So we're saying, can this potentially be, we're competing for the most nutritious food program in human history, better than anything that's ever come before it, because we've combed through all the evidence.
Yeah. And what do those eight supplements look like? Name a couple of them.
Well, for example, it's one is called Essentials, and it has like 26 different things.
Oh, so this is like your proprietary blend.
Yeah.
You don't know exactly what's in it, but.
Oh yeah, but we publish everything.
Okay.
So it's all transparent. But the food stack has 67 interventions. So 67, each therapy is based upon scientific evidence. And so we basically are bringing to a person 67 scientific therapies mm-hmm. in one go.
Lowering LDL and cleaning out the liver and
everything.
Things. Yeah, it's
whole,
amazing.
It's whole body.
Yeah.
And no one's ever done this before. People have tried to pick off these three or four things or like this supplement or that, but no one's put it together in an entire program. And we have several other products coming out in the next few months that will solve for the person's remaining calories of the day. So we're trying to say this will be the most scientifically backed program in history. And so we'll find variations. We'll find where it does well, where it doesn't well, who struggles. Like, we don't know, right? But we're following the evidence. Mm-hmm. And so we'll learn a lot.
How long is the study for?
90 days.
Okay. And then will you replicate it over and over and continue?
We'll see.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're learning a lot. People are going to measure body composition. So they'll get a scale. They'll do a wearable. So they'll look at things like sleep, exercise, heart rate variability. And then they'll do blood. And so in the small panel, there's 39 variables. In the big, large panel, I think there's like 69 or something like that. And all these are, highly verified, clinically relevant markers.
Yeah.
So I think it's really cool.
It's very cool.
In one week's time, we spun up one of the most significant studies in the history of anti-aging. And the participants are just amazing. It attracts such remarkable people. The community is really fun and energetic. So it's really great to be part of.
Where can someone listening go look at the study or find out more?
I'm trying to think where the link is at. If you go to the Blueprint website, blueprint.brianjohnson.com, there may be a link there. And you can apply to be as part of the next cohort. Yeah, we put this out. We had a slot for 2,500. And we got almost 13,000 applications mm-hmm. in a few days time period. And so we increased it to 5,000, which, like our team were like five people. And yeah. So it's been overwhelming trying to basically sort a 5,000 person community overnight.
Oh, yeah.
But we're making it through and it's fun. And everyone in the community has been so cool. They're like, I can jump in. I can help with customer support. I can help program this thing. So it really has a feeling of like, we feel like we're doing something historic together and everyone's in. And so that I think is really motivating for a lot of us.
Is there anything we left out that you want to talk about?
The people who have been the most important to me in life have invited me to pause and contemplate that everything I think I know in existence is not true. Now, even if that's offensive to your mind as an initial thought, if you breathe through that and you open up to the possibility that literally everything you believe to be true and that you value is no longer going to be true and valuable, you're at least at the starting point of where we're at as a species. Artificial intelligence is improving at a rate that is unimaginable to us. Nobody knows what happens next. And I think there's a high probability that we will need to evolve at a speed that breaks our brains, that what we want to hold on to the games we play, to our status and to our power and our beliefs, and those things are going to hold us back. And so in this moment, I would just say, I would invite all of us to engage in a thought exercise that if we want to participate in what could be the most magnificent experience in the galaxy, our best attribute may be adaptability. Not superimposing our wills upon the world, but to have the ability to roll with change at the speed at which it is being asked of us. But, you know, it's our opportunity. We're so lucky to exist in this moment. And what an amazing prize it would be to exist in a future where intelligence expands in directions and at depths that just are beyond our ability to comprehend. So yeah, enjoy the conversation. Appreciate you being here today and, you know, going through these topics. A lot of people, we talk a lot about, you know, daily habits and foods and things like that, but I think these conversations are even more important because they sit underneath habit selection. Like if you have a why for life, going to bed on time and eating well and exercising is so much easier. If you're just trying to do it for other reasons, sometimes it's hard to muster the power to do it. So I guess that's why I go to the why, is then you've got a burning source of energy and doing hard things is easier.
Appreciate you, man.
I mean, we were just sitting back, you know, chopping it up, reminiscing about the good old days and all that, you know, tracking my roots, where I came from.